Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Meredith F. Small. Small is a professor of anthropology at Cornell University, as well as a science journalist. Her work has appeared regularly in such journals and newspapers as Discover, Scientific American, and the New York Times. She's a regular commentator on NPR's All Things Considered. Small has also written several groundbreaking books, including Our Babies, Ourselves, and the newly published The Culture of Our Discontent, Beyond the Medical Model of Mental Illness, published by Joseph Henry Press this month, and what we will be discussing this evening. Welcome to the show, Meredith.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here after listening to your show for years.
Oh, that's great. That's great. A lot of people have asked me, as a trained anthropologist, what is it that made you want to get into the mental illness forum?
Well, first of all, like everyone, I have family, friends, acquaintances who are struggling with various mental health issues. And as an anthropologist, what always pops up for me is when I see something that's really common, I think to myself, well, what would it be like to look at this anthropologically, meaning deep in time, evolutionarily, and across cultures? And then a couple of years ago, there was an article in the New York Times Magazine, and it was about this behavior called lata that happens in Indonesia and Malaysia, and it's also known as the startle reflex. Mm-hmm. And it was all about how this occurs only in these particular populations. And that article went on to talk about something called culture-bound syndromes, meaning behaviors, moods, we might call them mental illnesses, that are bounded by a particular culture and not found in other cultures. Well, this, of course, you know, I was off and running once I read that. And then I began to look up all sorts of things using the internet, using the library, mm-hmm. talking to other anthropologists, and I just became totally fascinated by this issue.
I can understand after having read the book. Now you talk about the medical model of mental illness, and you're primarily talking about the West, the U.S. and Europe. Tell us exactly what you mean by that.
Well, whenever I talk about a culture, and I talk about Western culture, it's really a comparative statement. We tend to, you know, we live in our own culture. We think of it as the right, the best, the only way. And as an anthropologist, I know there are hundreds of ways to do everything. Mm-hmm. And so I'm comparing Western culture to other cultures. Western culture we think of as Europe, North America, cultures that are economically surpassing other cultures. We might include Japan in there, compared to less developed nations. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't just mean how we think of an underdeveloped or less developed nation. It really means the many different kinds of societies and cultures that are out there. There are small plot horticulturalists. There are hunters and gatherers. There are people who make their living in the Arctic different ways. So I'm interested in any of these issues across many, many cultures. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean countries. It really means cultures or societies.
Mm-hmm. And we've drawn artificial lines in countries to try to keep cultures sort of intact.
We have, and we have very stereotypical ideas. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in many of the Western cultures, we are really an amalgam of cultures. And that interests me as well. Mm-hmm. Immigrants to this culture, how do they take on what is already here? What do they give to us? Because culture isn't something stagnant. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are the culture. It's not a thing. Mm-hmm. It's who
it's
we
a
are.
Living.
It's a living, breathing, dynamic process. Uh-huh. Cultures change. People assimilate cultures. They reject cultures. And so when you talk about cultures, you have to really remember that. It's not just, oh, we've been the same for 4,000 years and that's it.
Uh-huh. So the medical model, let's talk a little bit more specific about the medical model of mental illness here in the West.
Yeah.
How do we deal with it?
Well, when I talk about the medical model, I'm really talking about the disease model of mental illness. Mm-hmm. And as you know from looking at the book, I was really struck by this when I went to the American Psychiatric Association meetings, convention would probably be the better word. And as I begin the book, I talk about going into the exhibit hall that is literally the size of a football field. And when I went in there, and this was in Chicago, it was full of booths, and they were all about pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. And when I go to a convention, an academic one, it's all the booksellers in the middle. But in this case, it was the pharmacies, and then pharmaceutical companies, and then around the edges were the booksellers.
That's unbelievable.
So it was spectacular. Banners hanging down, talking heads, barkers, giving away. People were standing in line to get their free laser pen with their name on it. And, of course, everyone in there is a mental health worker, psychiatrists, social work maybe, psychiatric mm-hmm. nurse, psychologists, mm-hmm. all kinds of people. And I wandered from booth to booth being really struck, as I never had before because I'm not an MD, how medication and the disease model has become so much part of how we envision mental health mm-hmm. or illness, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, mentality, mood. It really has mm-hmm. gripped our culture. I don't know if that's good or bad,
yeah.
but I'm fascinated by that.
I have been fascinated by the fact that there seems to be people out there peddling drugs for almost every ailment. And so your book does talk about the fact that maybe some of these aren't really ailments.
That's right.
Right?
Well, there are two things going on. One is the medical model, the disease model. If it's a disease, that suggests you can cure it. And that may not be true when mm-hmm. it comes to human mentality. Mm-hmm. And the other idea is that the pharmaceutical companies, as we all know, I'm certainly not the first person to say this, they're really pushing this stuff. You know, if you look on TV, if you look in any magazine, here's one condition after another. Now, this isn't to say that that's bad. Maybe these medications are really working, and we know they're working for a lot of people,
yes.
and they've
mm-hmm.
saved millions of lives. But what one has to question, and many of us do, is it too much?
Mm-hmm.
Is it too much? I'm not sure what the answer to that is. But the increase in the number of prescriptions written in America is shocking. It's absolutely shocking. Maybe it's helping people. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we also know a couple of problems with that. There's a huge placebo effect, especially with antidepressants, that it has a 40% placebo effect. And usually in double-blind clinical trials, they look for about a 30%. So you can feel better just because somebody writes you a prescription. Well, that's okay. You know, mm-hmm. that's all right, as long as you know that.
Yeah.
And I just think we have to watch what's going on here in terms of medication and also labeling something as a disease.
Well, I was just going to say that. It mm-hmm. seems like they're inventing new labels
yes.
as disease labels in order to give people drugs.
Right. And that's
you know,
a lot
it feels
to do
like the drug companies are taking over people's personalities.
And the health insurance companies.
Exactly.
If you have a diagnosis, and that's where the labels come in handy. You have a diagnosis, and then you have a possible treatment with the presumption of care, and that's a whole medical model. And that then allows for payment by health insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how we disassemble the bricks on all of that, but there
yeah.
it is.
Well, you talk about in your book a little bit of the history of mental illness in this mm-hmm. country, too, and how a French military MD in the 1940s started treating schizophrenics mm-hmm. with antihistamines.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Freud starting talk therapy. And
right.
and then now, recently in the last 30, 40 years, yes. it's been drugs.
Yes.
So.
The invention of antipsychotics was, Thorazine, was a miracle because it allowed schizophrenics to hang on to reality a little better and not live such horrible lives.
And they didn't have to be put away.
They didn't have to be put away. And so with that, with the use of antipsychotics, you have the mental hospitals emptying because mm-hmm. it's very expensive to keep people.
Mm.
And we know in New York State we had tons of mental hospitals, and now people are let out for good or ill, I don't know. And then following on the heels of that came the invention of antidepressants. And now we have a second class of antidepressants, and so they don't have a lot of the side effects that other ones did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, many things are coming off patent, and they're getting easier to use. And it is true that the family physician writes more antidepressant prescriptions than any psychiatrist do.
Hmm.
So that's where
amazing.
It's... And if you talk to the family physicians, they say, but people come in begging for them. So we really can't blame the doctors for doing this.
Yeah.
And it may be that what someone is taking is helping them get over a bad period and they'll be okay later.
Yeah, I think they are necessary in some cases. But my friends in Europe are shocked at how
yes.
drugged out this culture is.
That's right.
And when we have a drug war going on and yet we're, you know,
yes.
legally drugging half of our population.
It's absolutely true. My European friends as well, they,
uh-huh.
As you know, they have the pharmacy in a European country is full of organic sorts of products and,
herbs
and the idea that someone would be taking as many pills as Americans do is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But we're so used to it. It's amazing that in two generations here, we've had a real shift in how we think about our mental health.
Exactly. And the good thing is we can talk about it.
That's
it
the great thing.
It used to be this hidden thing and people
That's
were ashamed.
Right.
And
although
so
I still think a lot of people don't talk about
yeah.
it. And you notice in the book that I interview various people and sometimes they don't want their names used.
Yeah. Yeah, so. And so that's still going on. Well, let's talk about the evolutionary view of mental
okay.
illness. I mean, some evolutionary psychiatrists have suggested that some of these so-called abnormal mental states, like I said, are actually, they had an evolutionary
yes.
reason for, for survival, perhaps.
This was one of the most fun parts to interview and read about because it's one of those theories or ideas that tips our thoughts are our conception of something totally on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the work of Randy Nessie and several other people. And they are taking a completely different approach. And these are psychiatrists, MD psychiatrists, who have decided that what's missing from the Western model of mental illness is evolution.
Mm.
And that if we look at these behaviors or mentalities and ask the question, could this have been adaptive in terms of evolution? What do we come up with here? Here's anxiety, depression, schizophrenia. It's all over the world. Why is that? Is there some selective advantage for this? And there are all kinds of great answers possibilities, that schizophrenia actually can be useful if you live in a family full of a lot of emotional, interpersonal trauma, and this gets you to retreat.
Mm.
Or you're someone with a very elastic sort of mentality that works well as a teenager, but then it just fizzles out. I mean, we have this very complex brain. We're very intelligent. It can go wrong. Depression, the idea that maybe in a situation you should be depressed. Things are not going well. This has you retreat to your house. You don't take risks. Maybe this is protecting you. Anxiety, well, that's just the fight or flight response. And sometimes it's good to really run. Anxiety is the most widespread negative mental behavior in the world. And maybe that's the thing that helped people, not jump off the cliff or run away from the lion or whatever, that it was useful. And therefore, it's part of who we are. It's part of human nature. We might consider it negative, but under particular circumstances, it might be just the thing.
Yeah, because I always think of anxiety as the fact we are still animals, and we forget
yes.
that. And I have animals, and I've brought up animals all my life. And I think anxiety is a good thing. It has to do with survival, I think, to be anxious sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so I do wonder what all this drugging is doing to us as human beings in regard to personality. And
part of the problem with anxiety is that it releases into the body cortisol, which is a hormone that works really well if you step out into the street and here comes a car and it gets you to jump back from the street. But over time, cortisol is actually very destructive to the body, body tissues, and it really can wear you down.
Yeah.
And that's why over time, anxiety can be such a health issue for people.
Yeah, so it's best not to stay in that state very long, I suppose.
Well,
let's move on to some of the, you talked a lot about the psychological experiments that Harry Harlow did, conducted with primates.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about what he found in regard to isolation and how they react to that.
When Harlow was working back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, people really believed that babies should be taken away from their mothers in the hospital, protected in terms of hygiene, isolated so they didn't get germs, and they really didn't need mother love. And Harlow felt completely differently. And he decided to use what's called an isolate-reared monkey experiment. And this is University of Wisconsin. So they took little rhesus monkeys, your basic monkey, took them off their mothers at birth, raised them in a nursery for a little while, and then put them in with monkeys their same age. In other words, they got no mother love.
Mm-hmm.
And they discovered that when those monkeys grew up, they were aggressive. They didn't know how to parent themselves. If they had babies, they would step on them. They were not good friends. They were socially inept. Harlow took the experiment even further. He put these monkeys into a funnel called the funnel of despair, where they had no contact whatsoever with anyone or anything. And these monkeys quickly went crazy. And what Harlow showed us is that interpersonal interaction is so important to development, and that it can, in fact, make us crazy. And we're primates just like those monkeys. Mm-hmm. Think about disconnecting a child from its caregiver, its parents, receiving no contact, no love, and it makes us crazy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Meredith Small. She's an anthropologist from Cornell University. Let's talk about the subject of diet, because that has been one of my pet peeves forever. And people forget how important it really is in regard to our mental health.
Well, it's funny. We think about chocolate. It's really helping. That certainly helps me. Caffeine. We know that speeds us up and has us run around and a little cheery. Nicotine, same thing. Alcohol is a depressant. But the arena in which I have become most fascinated is the issue of omega-3 fatty acids. And this is the work of Joe Hiblin, who's an NIH lipid biochemist and psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And what Joe and others have looked at is the balance between what are called omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. Now, first of all, we think that eating fat is bad, but we need fat for our brains and our bodies to work. And the problem with Western culture is we don't get very many omega-3 fatty acids. These are essential fatty acids. You have to eat them. You don't get them any other way. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of omega-6s. Joe can explain how it goes from eating that, ingesting that, and how that affects the brain. And quite simply, the brain is 60% fat. It's a lump of fat. It's like a hunk of butter. And if you change the omega-3 and 6s out of balance from 50-50, the channels in that butter, that brain butter, through which chemical and electrical signals go, they stiffen up. And so the signals are not passing quickly. Mm-hmm. And what Joe did was look at the relationship between the amount of fish that people eat,
because
which
is fish omega-3,
is very
right?
high in omega-3 fatty acids, and the rate of depression across cultures. Mm-hmm. And he found that when you see a lot of fish eating, very low rates of depression. And even if you take out Japan, Hong Kong, cultures that typically eat a lot of fish, the relationship still holds. To me, that's quite shocking.
It is.
Then he made an association between postpartum depression, homicide, negative behaviors in general, and he was also able to take spinal fluid from volunteers and look at the amount of omega-3 fatty acids they ate in terms of fish, and their spinal fluid, a marker for serotonin. And he found that people who ate less had less circulating markers of serotonin. So that the biochemical relationship is all there. Now, what's happening in Western culture is our processed food diet is full of omega-6 fatty acids and not the 3s, especially in soybean oil, palm oil, and then it's hydrogenated and it's even worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, try to go to the grocery store and find anything that has a wrapper on it that doesn't have hydrogenated oil. And I know because I've done that.
Yeah, I check labels all the time as well. It's
really
shocking.
Hard. And part of the shocking part is, what are our kids getting to eat in school? What are the snacks like? And once you hook on to this, it gets a little scary. More interesting, psychiatrists who are interested in omega-3 fatty acids are giving them to their patients in terms of fish oil capsules.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they improve. And they improve people whose medication is not working well. They add in the fish oil and they do much better. So we have both the association with culture. We have NIH doing clinical trials. Mm-hmm. We have treatment actually working.
But we also have drug companies that want to make big profits, and
that's
I
right.
don't really think people are going to suggest diets when that is really
that's dependent upon
their livings.
That's right.
To start continue
and it sounds so wacky.
Drugs. I know.
It sounds wacky. Eat fish oil capsules and you'll be much better. I mean, it sounds like something that, you know, somebody somewhere else came up with, but in fact, this is NIH.
Yeah. And it is shocking, that Western diet. I've had problems with it forever.
Yeah,
the way people eat it and the way kids eat in schools and
well, it's funny,
fast food diets and so on.
We think about Western culture as a very advanced culture, and in that we think about we're a civilization and we're able to feed millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
But what we forget is, along with that comes the diseases of civilization, and those are diabetes, mental health, cancer, and heart disease.
Yeah,
and all of those are affected by diet, but we refuse to change our diet.
And then we do. We see people who immigrate here from cultures
that's right.
where they eat a lot of fish and rice, like the Asian cultures. they start adapting to our mm-hmm. diets and they start getting the same diseases unheard of in their countries, like heart disease and so on. So it's so obvious
it's
to
obvious.
Me. I can't believe nobody's doing about it.
That's an interesting culture. It's so obvious. What is it about the human mind that has trouble digesting that and won't actually, we don't do what we're told?
Well, the human mind in the Western culture is very corporate.
Yes, true.
But let's talk about the part in your book that really I found fascinating was how people in different countries and different cultures even think about mental illness.
That's
sometimes
right.
what we call mental illness is not the way they That's react
right.
to it. And to talk to us about things.
I think some of the most shocking information is that people in other cultures can have moments of what we would call schizophrenia. And let me just explain some of these conditions because they're like a Ripley's Believe It or Not. But we have those as well, let me just say. There's a condition called choro, in which men believe that their penises are being resorbed back into their bodies. And this sounds really crazy to us. I mean, it's not really happening. But interestingly enough, the fear of this can spread like an epidemic. And it can also spread to women. But then it doesn't last very long. It goes away, and people never do it again. This is not the way we envision schizophrenia at all.
No.
The one I mentioned before, Lata, the startle reflex, we would never think of someone who jumps when we turn and talk to them as a mental illness. But this is very common in Southeast Asia. And these women are thought of as usually older women, and everyone enjoys them. People like to scare them and watch them jump. But nobody is put away in an institution. Nobody is medicated at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so interesting that over time, historically, you can look in Western culture and see the same thing, where hysteria was the thing, fainting on the
witch
couch.
Witch hunt era.
Exactly. Witch hunting, anorexia nervosa only occurs in cultures. Not, you know, Western cultures are ones that have become Westernized, uh-huh. where there's lots of food.
Uh-huh. And affluence.
Well,
usually, right?
And affluence.
Yeah.
And running amok. In this culture, we think of amok as someone who picks up a rifle and kills people. Amok takes on an entirely different format in the Arctic, where women and men become agitated, upset. They run around screaming. They roll down in the snow. They fall asleep. They wake up in the morning. They remember nothing. And this can happen once and never again, or it can happen repeatedly. It's also interesting that when schizophrenics are identified as such, they do better in non-Western cultures.
Hmm.
And when I've asked psychiatrists, international psychiatrists, why that is, they say the prognosis is better because they are not medicated and they are kept within the community. And in fact, a gentleman named Javier Escobar, who was running an office of global mental health for NIMH, said to me, people do better with mental health in other cultures anyway because there are grassroots mental health workers and clinics. They don't have the technologies, mm-hmm. they don't have the medication, but there's always someone to talk to who's right there with everyone in the community.
So they don't have the stigma.
They don't have
either,
the stigma.
Either,
everyone knows,
we were
you know,
about,
this is the person who has problems. It's not that they don't recognize there's a problem, but there's not the put them away somewhere, which I think we still sort of have that kind of,
we do.
The fear of people with mental illnesses mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. this culture as well.
I'm also fascinated by the cultures that think evil spirits have gotten into
yes.
people and they call on healers.
Yes.
So talk to us a little
yes.
bit about some of your.
There are some wonderful descriptions of cultures, and many of these come from anthropologists who went out in the 1930s and 40s and studied cultures before they became Westernized. And the Azande, for example, believe that everything is caused by witches, the good things and the bad things. And anyone can become a witch. I call it witchness in the in the book. And the way to get around this is to take two chickens out and poison them and watch how they run around. And that then is an oracle about what you should do and who the witch is. So anyone can be accused of a witch. Now, this sounds really unsettling to us. What a horrible way to live. You
mm-hmm.
know, that
mm-hmm.
paranoia that someone is casting a spell at you. But in fact, it's a way to really make the society cohesive. There's always someone to blame. There's always sort of an external force that causes things, almost like we use biochemistry, brain biochemistry. There's that external force we're causing. It's not your fault. And it causes the same kind of cohesiveness to these societies. There are bad things come to you mentally from witches, demons, from the ancestors, but there are also ways to fix it. And that is, you go to the sorcerer or you go to the other witch, and they have ways to help cure you. You do a trance dance if you're a Kung San, or Kung San, I should say. And that helps. And it makes the mental illness part of the collective. Everyone is dealing with it. Everybody's getting rid of it. And it brings out into the open. Maybe that's what we're doing here. We're making mental illness in Western culture part of the collective by making it part of medicine.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. And the drugs are helping people to appear normal.
Yes.
So they are becoming part of the collective in that way as well.
Right. And getting on with their lives.
Yeah, exactly. You started early on talking about cultural bound syndrome, where there's mental illness found in one culture and not another. Can you give us some more specifics?
Well, there's Arctic hysteria, I mentioned. And right. What's interesting about Arctic hysteria is that it has... You find something like that in other cultures, and it goes by different names. In Puerto Rico, young males will all have the same kind of nervous disorder. We would call it agitation or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In China, they still accept the diagnosis called neurasthenia, and that's something that was used in America at the turn of the century, but we no longer use that. But it has all the symptoms of depression. But, and this is Arthur Kleinman, the anthropologist who spent many years in China going into clinics with people and recognizing some of the symptoms of depression, but seeing that there were also other symptoms that are not depression. And so other cultures are putting labels on things just as we do.
Mm-hmm.
We all, each culture just interprets them as negative behaviors.
Yeah. We used to call all kinds of things nervous breakdowns.
Nervous
too,
breakdown.
Right?
There is no such thing, really, but maybe there is in the Arctic. A nervous breakdown, what does that mean? It means somebody just can't take it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But it's still in the vernacular in Western culture,
yeah.
A nervous breakdown. But a psychologist or psychiatrist would say there is no such thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We only have a couple more minutes. In your last chapter, I want to quote what you say. Mental illness is human misery. The opposite of misery is not happiness, but hope.
Yes.
So tell us what you meant by that.
I actually got that from Randy Nessie, who is an evolutionary psychiatrist, who you think that somebody who works with mental patients all the time would maybe become unhappy himself. But this is a gentleman full of hope, and also Arthur Kleinman, the last person I interviewed in the book, who's an anthropologist. They both talked about hope, that really the opposite of depression is not happiness, it's hope. And when you think of it, when someone is depressed, and we've all felt depressed in our lives, you feel hopeless, that nothing's going to get better, that you can't figure your way out of this dark corner. And really what people need to be given is hope. And Nessie uses the example of a woman who comes in, she's really depressed, she can't figure out why, and they work through her life, and it turns out she's middle-aged, she's worried about her husband, and he tells her, go back to school, get a job. And he said, and I said to him, and what happens? He said, she got better because she had hope that her life was not in this one basket. And that, of course, sometimes is a hard thing to remember and a hard thing to put into action.
Mm-hmm.
But hope is really what it's all about.
Meredith Moss, thank you so much for joining us. And I do recommend this book highly. It was very fascinating,
even to
a layperson like myself. So
right.
I hope everybody reads it, learn a little bit about their own lives.
Thank you, Tish.
Thank you so much. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.